I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, before we get going, this is Aaron, one of the co-hosts of this show. I actually have a new podcast. It's called Stoner. It's interviews with creative, interesting, productive people who like weed. Marijuana. We also have some people who work in the marijuana economy on the show, but it's mostly artists and musicians and people who make the internet and all kinds of people talking about weed. So if you or someone you know or love might be interested in that show, check it out. You can find it anywhere that podcasts are found. Stoner. Okay, here's the show. Hello and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer, here with Evan Ratliff of The Atavist and Max Linsky of Longform. Hello.
Hey, you guys.
This week on the show, someone I've wanted to have on for a long time. Someone who I was not sure would come on the podcast or was even like a real person with the name that she purported to have on Twitter. Patricia Lockwood, poet, but she just wrote a memoir. It's called Priest Daddy. It's about what happened when she and her husband had a medical emergency and they had to move back in with her parents. Her father is a very, very unusual priest.
I like the sound of this.
I feel like I should apologize to Patricia Lockwood.
Yeah.
Because she got here before you did for that interview and I had to leave and I just stuck her in a room with other people she didn't know and left also.
Yeah, I think it was her and Wesley Morris, but she did know who Wesley Morris was.
it was not hospitable.
If you're going to be stuck in a room with someone, Wesley Morris is one
it
of could, the best,
it
probably.
It could be worse than getting stuck in a room with Wesley. Still, sorry.
We are brought to you, as always, by the good people at MailChimp. Wait, we got something a little different with MailChimp. We got readthissummer.com.
This summer, the three of us have curated a reading list of books for the fine people at MailChimp, and we encourage you, the listeners, to read along with us.
It all culminates in a festival in Decatur, Georgia, not actually the home of MailChimp, but spiritual home of MailChimp.
That's right. The Decatur Book Festival is like the largest independent book festival in the country, and Evan and I are going. You're not going, Aaron.
I was invited, though.
I
haven't been banned, if that's what listeners are thinking. I have a wedding to attend.
Max, give them one example of a book that's on this list and an author that's coming to the Decatur Book Festival.
How to Be a Person in the World by Heather Havrileski. Her advice is unparalleled. And she will be there with us at the Decatur Book Festival.
So go check out that book. And in the meantime, here's Aaron with Patricia Lockwood.
Welcome, Patricia Lockwood. I have a lot of questions for you, and this is unusual for me because I just finished your book, Priest Daddy. And normally when people come on the show, I'm like, hey, how did you become a writer? And you kind of wrote a book about how you became a writer.
Mm.
Or you wrote a book about the period of your life where you started doing this.
Yeah, I did that so that I wouldn't get that question.
So let's go further back. And at what point in your life did you start thinking, I want to write things and have other people read them?
Mm. So it goes back for me pretty far, but I don't know that I had a whole lot of models in my life for being a writer. It wasn't like I looked around at my family and there were all these brilliant writers, but I did have an uncle who was an artist, which I do write about in the book a little bit. And I think having a person in your family who is a writer or an artist or who is engaged in the arts in some way, it's like having a suicide in the family. It makes it seem possible, right?
Yeah.
It gives you that example to look towards. So I was very, very young. I mean, it's something I can always remember thinking about, really. It was more about just finding a form for me.
The places that you grew up, your father was a priest.
Can I cuss?
You can totally cuss.
Shitholes.
Shitholes. You grew up in shitholes.
Shitholes.
Shitholes with light salting of Christianity or a heavy dose.
Heavy salt.
Heavy
salt
of Christianity. So the people that you were growing up around, when people would get who would want to be involved in something artistic and mm-hmm. creative. Are we talking like Christian bands?
No, nothing like that. And I think we have this idea about the Midwest or about Rust Belt cities that there aren't like creative scenes there.
Right.
And there really are. It's just that I had no access to them. And particularly as a child, it wasn't like there were tons of cultural events around the city that my parents were taking me to or anything like that. But no, those things absolutely exist there and those ambitions exist there. It has to do with whether or not people can get connected to a scene and whether that scene can get connected to the wider world in such a way that it gains attention. But no, it's not like a barren cultural wasteland where people are just starting Christian rock bands. I mean, we have some of those, but I almost feel like they're coming from somewhere else.
So when you're in these barren wastelands that have far more than Christian rock bands in them, it seems like the new ingredient that emerged during your lifetime was the internet.
Yeah.
When did you get the internet?
I feel it was about the mid-90s.
Yeah.
And we had, again, one of those huge-ass computers that was basically like a box that you get at Costco to put all of your, like, cans of V8 in or something like that. Like, you literally could fit a human head in it. And it would make that crazy dial-up sound. What was that McKelvey tweet recently that he was like, back in the day when you had to kill a robot to get online and it screams power to your internet? It's like, that's how it felt, you know?
Yeah. So you got one computer in the house.
It's
from
the
a big
family computer.
And you're from a pretty big family.
It's the large
Irish
Catholic family.
So there's a lot of hands on the computer.
It's a sticky keyboard, yeah.
Did the computer as a vessel for personal expression occur to you?
That was not until a little bit later. I mean, I talk in the book a little bit. At one point, I was like researching suicide methods on the family computer. So there was no sense that anyone was like looking at your search history in the way that parents now would be like, well, let's make sure that my kid is not researching suicide methods online.
That would have been weird with a bunch of kids, too. You're like, which one of you kids was searching for suicide information?
It would very obviously have been me. This was before we had emos, and it was after goth. So there was really nothing for me to do. There was no cool configuration for me to put my hair into. But it wasn't until later on, actually, that there were things like bulletin boards and poetry chat rooms were great because you could go into a private room and then you could just, you know, have cyber sex. But it was more lyrical than it generally was.
Okay. I'm really interested in poetry chat rooms because I've never been in one, but I was part of the chat generation.
That chat generation.
Okay. So, like, tell me about the person that you were when you started hanging out in poetry chat rooms. Were you writing poetry? Were you posting poetry to the chat room?
No, I was not posting it to the chat room because it was like a pain in the ass to do that. You had to do it like a line at a time. It was mostly just to find like-minded people, which I don't know. I mean, your font could be a different color. It's like, yeah. Of course that's where I was going to be.
What kind of poetry were you reading at the time?
Oh, gosh. When I think back to it, I think I was probably reading like a ton of Rilke at that point. I got really obsessed with him. And I was like, oh, his poetry is like full of angels, but they have dicks and they fuck for sure, you know. So at that time, I was writing a lot of stuff that was like heavy, heavy Jesus poetry.
What was it like finding like-minded people after coming from a place where people were not particularly like-minded?
Well, I liked to be online because I was just like a string of text. So I don't even think it was so much that I was like this yearning hand reaching out of my chest for other like-minded people of my kind. It wasn't even like that. I just liked to be a sentence pretty much that was floating in the ether towards someone else. And it's not true, really, that I had never known like-minded people. I went to like a very sort of artistic high school.
Uh-huh.
And the 90s felt to me like a very creative DIY decade, too.
Yeah.
Which that comes around every so often. So I feel like we're back in that again. Like,
do you feel that way? I do. I feel that way.
I think it goes in like 20
aesthetic,
year cycles.
Like packaging,
yeah.
Kind of. Okay, 20 years? Okay.
I think so. So like.
So we're experiencing like the 1997 loop right now?
50s, 70s, 90s. Now, you know, it sort of goes in like 20, 25 year cycles along with fashion.
What was the first time you shared your own work in poetry?
Gosh, I don't even remember. I mean, there could be a couple of different, you know, answers to that. There's, you know, you win a contest in fourth grade. That's
yeah.
Something you get your first actual poem published when you're like 19 or something like that.
Yeah.
Or there's a bunch of different instances of becoming very tinily visible to very select groups. Yeah.
You published a book of poetry in 2012.
I think so.
It was kind of before really anyone was following you. It was before.
Oh, yeah. No one knew who I was.
It was a shot in the dark.
Definitely.
And I guess most poetry books are shots in the dark, so that's not shocking. But where did the creative process that ended up with you having a book of poems that was done that you could put a label on it?
Yeah, for true. Okay, so I'm a person who's had a manuscript of poetry in hand, this big old chunk, basically since I was 16 years old. And all that would happen is that I would just write new poems, replace old ones in the manuscript, and eventually end up with a totally different chunk. Mm. So by the time that Balloon Pop was published, I had already gone through like four manuscripts. And Balloon Pop, Outlaw Black, it was really the product of an indie scene that happened in poetry like a while back with presses like Wave and Octopus and Black Ocean that sort of arose as a counter effort against more academic presses. Mm. So a lot of these guys hooked up at the big writing conferences, AWP, and they started putting out cooler books that had a little bit better art. And a side effect of the fact that it, you know, came out of these smaller circles is that people were really publishing their friends. So by the time I got my book accepted by Octopus, I think they were reaching out more to people they didn't know. So the process of it getting published was very interesting. It was totally a shot in the dark. It had been, you know, like a finalist for some other things. Some other people were considering it. But I didn't know anyone. I didn't know those guys. And it was just, you know, I got that email one day that was like, we chose this as, you know, the book that we're going to publish, or one of the books we're going to publish this year.
I'm curious about the process of toiling in oblivion.
Mm.
When
I like that. When That's the part I like.
When you have those three or four books of poetry that have like slowly been overwritten by new material.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know a lot of people who write narrative books will say like, oh, I have like two novels in the drawer from like I wrote before I showed it to anyone. Is it difficult to keep track of your place in time and space and
totally
see a sense of progression in your work when you're working like that?
Yeah, a little bit. And something that poets do to counteract that is to start project books, you know, where they're like, I'm going to base these on Emily Dickinson's Master Letters or something like that, because it gives a more firmly delimited idea to that. Because otherwise it's like you're in this slipstream and it's just very fluid. And what's happening is that you're feeling, before you have a book published at all, you're feeling this sort of a propulsive energy in yourself that has nowhere to go. It has no outlet. And all that it results in is the creation of new poems, basically.
Your first two collections, the second one is Motherland, Fatherland, Homeland, Sexual.
Very well done.
They're pretty different.
Yeah.
Like what happened in that span, and what happened to your writing during that span between those first couple books?
It is funny because a lot of times people talk about my poetry, they're like, this is her smutty, transgressive poetry. But if you read the first book, it's like there's no sex in it really
at
all.
But you hadn't heard about sex
yet. It's about cartoons. I had not yet learned about sex. Well, I'm unusual, maybe, in that as soon as I'm done with a book, I sort of forget how to write completely. I forget how I did it. As soon as I open that new file or start that new notebook, anything can really happen there. So like the form can just radically change. It's almost like a new voice arrives. Now with Motherland, Fatherland, Homeland, Sexuals, that was the result of a sort of concerted effort to see if I could bring humor into my poetry. Because I'm like, well, I'm a funny person. My poems are never funny to the point where, you know, sometimes they like make you want to die. So is there something I can do where I can bring in this voice that is sort of like surreal and absurd? And it's a sort of like anything goes impulse. Can I bring that in to my previous poetry, which was a little bit more contemplative and up its own ass?
A corollary that occurred to me was, like, I had no idea what you were going to be like when you walked into this room.
Mm.
Like, you could be very quiet and introspective and say, like,
that's not, no.
smutty Twitter, poet is, like, not a character I play, but, like, that's my written voice. And you'll meet comedians sometimes who you sit down in a room with them and they're actually kind of quiet, withdrawn.
You hear this about Christopher Guest, who's, like, one of my favorite comedy guys. Like, you talk to him in person, apparently, and he never tells a joke.
Well, I thought maybe, like, here's what I was thinking when we came into the room. I was like, I know you outside of this book, because I've been following your writing for a pretty long time now, as someone who wants to get the perfect sentence, the perfect phrase.
Yeah.
And I could understand if you were like, well, I don't want to run my mouth on the microphone.
Oh, no, I love to run my mouth. Okay. Yeah, that's my second favorite thing after getting the perfect sentence is running my mouth, yeah.
Okay, so during the period, like, there's something that happened in the period between the first and the second book where it seemed like both the humor and the, like, filthy jokes kind of element came in, but also it feels more like you. I got more of, much more of an impression of like who you are and sort of what your story is.
Yeah. But this is something that happens when I interact with people. Hmm. When I'm in a room alone, I fall to a default state that feels to me the most like me. And that is the state that produces the really serious poems. So I might be one of those Dr. Jekylls.
Yeah. They,
those crop up from time to time. But it really, I mean, both sides, I think, are genuinely myself. But, you know, they're different.
When did you get on Twitter?
2011.
What did Twitter do for you?
Honestly, it gave me some friends, like some cool friends. And it's the only reason I'm sitting here right now. You know,
yeah.
it's the reason that I have a book like Priest Daddy. It's the reason I have the third book. Yeah.
What was it like as someone who was like, I assume you spend a lot of your time writing poetry, like in Priest Daddy, like there's not many that like 9-to-5 jobs.
There's not, there's no jobs in it. There's almost not a single job in that book.
It's one of the most unemployable books.
Yes.
Possible.
Unemployed books. Unemployed. Yes. And unemployable. Books.
So I'm assuming that you spend like a lot of your time writing. And or at least like engage in the overall project of writing.
Yeah, I spend a lot of my time in a receptive state that to an outsider would just appear like a sort of kind of vacant insanity that to me feels like a holy state that is waiting for the poems to come.
And you started posting things on Twitter that like, I don't like to get into like, is it poetry or is it not poetry kind of discussions.
You'd be the first who didn't like to get into that.
Whether you consider them poetry or not, some of them started getting more attention than your poetry. Like the first thing you wrote that I came across was a really good tweet. What was it like getting attention for something that wasn't your primary outlet?
Well, I mean, I've talked about this a little bit, but I really am like in the public sphere, kind of like a clown, like kind of like a little attention hog.
Yeah.
So that seems fairly
like
normal
attention.
To me. Well, it just seems like if you're a person who wants to, you know, run your mouth, it's just like fairly natural that, you know, people start to look at you because you're saying insane things. But what I like is to have a new space. I like to have a new box to type in. And when I get something like that, it frees me up a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, so Twitter now feels much more rigid, more like encrusted. But, you know, back when it first started, I had honestly like one of those little phones that you had a little keyboard that you type on. And it just seemed fun. Like no one was paying attention to what I did. And then eventually they were paying attention. And that I took in the general course of things.
I think of like a lot of distinctions between publishing poetry and Twitter.
Yeah.
And I think the obvious one to discuss is like, ooh, it's ultra compressed. It's only 140 characters. Mm-hmm. You have to think of every word.
But now we have tweet threads and things like that. So, I mean, we have screenshots. Like, is it even that compressed
maybe
anymore?
Maybe it's not.
Maybe it's not.
The part that strikes me as kind of radical for someone in the situation you were in is publishing daily. Like, writing something out, publishing it, and then getting the, like, the pushback. What was it like writing so much in real time?
Well, it's it really is a, like a rat with a pellet situation. Like you do have to be careful that you're not training your brain to just like hit that send button and like watch the little pellets flood in. Because I don't think that's really great for you.
Yeah.
It's good for you maybe as a public personality, but it's not good for you as a writer. So you do have to have these chunks of time where you're just completely unplugged from it. Like you can't look at it, which is harder and harder at the current moment. Because what has happened in the time that we have been talking? We could be at war. The world is moving. It's like time put on like 7-league boots or something is how it feels.
I mean, you have something in common with Donald Trump and that you both owe your careers to Twitter.
Oh, boo. Boo.
So, What inspired you to write a book in the first place? I actually was surprised when I had heard that you were writing a memoir.
Yeah, like, it's, yeah.
Like something that I've like admire a lot about your writing was like it being kind of a moving target
mm-hmm.
where it was like, I don't even really know what she's really like. Yeah, this could all be kind of made up.
Camouflage, yeah.
And now I know a lot about you, and the book's
but
really
excellent.
But
do you?
Well, the period where I was reading your tweets that I really liked, now I kind of know, like, what bedroom you were sleeping in.
It's so funny, because I have not ever mentioned this to anyone, but that Jonathan Franzen tweet that is always, every time he comes into the news and says something about, like, an orphan he thought about adopting, gets retweeted, like, a million times. I wrote that living in the rectory. It was one of the first things in the file that was, like, the rough draft of my book, because I didn't know what my book was going to be like. So it just had all these little, like, surreal paragraphs, and that was out of that. The Paris Review tweet was when I lived with my parents.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's fascinating in its own right to sort of see the same thing twice from different perspectives.
Yeah.
But I'm curious what it's like for you and what it was like reliving fairly recent history.
Well, because you said you were surprised when you found out that I was writing a memoir. But I sort of had to. I was super, super poor. We had moved back in with my parents, like, because, you know, my husband had this crazy medical crisis and we had had to raise the money so that he could get the surgery in the first place. And then when things went a little bit haywire, we had no backup. Like, we had basically no choice. And so, you know, I'm sitting there, I'm listening to my parents talk, I'm writing down what they say. And I think to myself, you know, I always said I wouldn't do this.
Yeah.
You know, that's not the sort of book that I thought I would write. But I was writing it. You know, it was already happening.
Yeah.
And it didn't feel totally natural. And I've talked about this a little bit too. Like, I wanted to keep certain chapters set aside where it felt like I could do something more lyrical or something that was closer to poetry in them. Because otherwise, I mean, there is something deadening about always in your writing having to know what day it was, you know, who said this first, like, what did I eat for breakfast that morning? Is this true?
Yeah.
Those are generally not the kind of considerations that are on your mind when you write poetry.
Well, the book starts off as kind of a straightforward, like, this is who I am. This is how I ended up in this situation. And then it kind of explodes into a lot of different threads.
Yeah, which I wanted to do formally because I think you can do interesting things with form. It's one of the places where you can explode it. And, like, we're still doing that. We're still mixing it up, I think, in a way that is interesting or has a lot of possibilities.
When you started writing about your family, certainly, like, I don't think the book is ultimately making fun of your family. But if someone wrote a book about me that was included these details, I would
kill them.
Yeah, I would not take
them. Oh,
no,
I would murder that person. Yeah.
So the book is a lot about being poor, and it's a lot about class, and it's a lot about, for me as a reader, going to a place that's pretty different than where I grew up and where I live. How were you thinking about those issues when you were depicting your own family and how people would perceive them and how they would perceive themselves if they read the book?
My family occupies such a weird class position because my dad was a rich boy.
Right.
My dad was a rich boy who idolized the blue collar and working class to such a degree that he made sure that his sons would belong to it, or that, you know, his daughters would not get an education. So it was this very interesting thing where he had had access to, like, all those glories of the world that you would want, and he somehow put us in the position where we could not have those things. So I think it is an affectionate portrayal, and that has been the feedback that I've received. But you're right, like, if someone told me they were writing a book about me, I would make sure that they did not leave the room alive. So there's a generosity, like, you can say what you will about my family, say what you will about my parents, but there's a generosity even in, you know, like, continuing to talk to a person after they undertake that task.
At the same time, your portrayal of your father, you're a person who has a strong personality. And so it's not entirely shocking that you're the child of someone who's a very large personality.
Yeah, very large personality, yeah.
Is that, like, something that occurred to you as a... like, when did you kind of, like, connect those dots?
Yeah, no, and that is true. And people have kind of brought that to my attention. But it's funny because my mom is a much more retiring person, but her language is also this kind of, like, cartoon language that is very quotable. My dad is physically, like, he's like a cartoon in every respect. And the thing that I think, when I think about what I inherited from him, it really is, like, his mouth. We don't think before we say anything. We just open it up and whatever comes out is what comes out. But for my mom, it's that more careful desire to set things down in a very precise form that she can control, that she feels that she can make perfect.
what happens when you have to fill up a whole book and not a poem with these things?
I think in my proposal, I was like, this book might be 50,000 words, because I didn't think that there was any way. But as I kept going, I tended to concentrate specifically on chapters in themselves and not think as much about what the arc was like necessarily as I was concentrating on the certain chapters. So they kind of unfolded within themselves. And before you knew it, you were like, good God, this book is like 333 pages. Half of the devil's number, might I add.
Was it difficult as you started to approach the present day? Like, the book starts, you're 19 in the start at the start of the book, I think.
Yeah, I
right?
guess technically. Although I do dip back into childhood and right. things like that. But yeah, but like, I would say 19, yeah.
Yeah, so as the book goes on, you're closer to you mm-hmm. now. And I think most people are like, whoa, I do not want to write about myself right now.
I don't know if I feel that way. I think the writing in the book that is about me that feels the most intimate is about writing. It's about yeah. like the way I think, or it's about my process. And those were the pieces I kept trying to take out. And my husband was like, no, those are like the interesting pieces.
So you talked about showing the drafts to your husband, mm. who's also a pretty big character in the book.
Yeah.
A calming presence.
Yes,
in the book.
A presence.
And you're unusual in that you've been in a relationship basically like during your entire development as
yeah.
a writer.
That's weird. Is that weird to you guys, to someone like you reading the book, that
no.
someone like me gets married when they're 21?
No, I don't think it's actually that weird yeah. to get married. I know people who've been with the same person since they were in college.
Yeah.
I don't know someone who's had the same reader and the same
yeah,
like
God,
bouncing board for their entire time. Usually mm-hmm. it's like you spend some time making like art and literature, and then you find like another writer and it's like, oh, now
yeah.
we're sharing our work. And you've had the same reader
mm-hmm.
for a lot of that time. Like, what was that like in the early days, and how has it evolved over time?
Well, it's different with poetry because you would only, you know, show them the poem once you're finished. And once you feel that it's finished enough that someone else can look at it. So
yeah.
he was never involved in that sort of way, you know, where it was like this collaboration between us. It was always, I gave him things that I felt were done.
Right.
This was not like that. Priest Daddy was not like that. I actively enlisted him to go forth into the household and collect conversations, to write things down, to really help me in that regard, and to read as I went. I mean, so this book felt more malleable, like a more protein, like a more fluid as it went, because I was telling people, I was like, I can change this. I want your opinion. I don't give a shit what you think about my poetry, but I want to know what you think about this chapter and how I can make it better.
What were people's reactions to the early drafts like?
Oh, man. I had maybe like 3 readers. And generally, the feedback was just along the lines of like, there needs to be more in it. You know, so I write a skeleton and it needs to be fleshed out. So good readers, or like my editor, who's an excellent, excellent fucking editor, he just sort of guides you gently along the path of coaxing more out of you. Because in reality, and you wouldn't know this, you know, sitting down with me today, I'm reticent. So the initial draft of this, or the initial drafts of the chapters, I sort of had to be drawn out to put in those things that were maybe more unflattering,
mm.
that were like a little bit harder. It was very, very difficult for me to quote certain lines of my father's that were very pertinent. I didn't write the scene where he tells me that I can't go to college until like 2 months before I turned in the draft.
Because you were worried it made him look bad?
In a way, but it also felt like complaining.
Hmm.
So what you don't want to do when you write a memoir is to write a complaining book. I mean, that's, to me, that's the number one thing you go into it, like not to write the complaining book. And it felt like any time I said something specific, I'm like, is this complaining?
I never thought it was complainy at all.
Thank you.
But
thank you.
Thank God. The part that was striking for me as someone who'd been reading your work was, sincere is the wrong word, but there is like a literalness to your prose writing, and you're talking about real people where it can't end on that like half done tweet where it hits you in a kind of a sideways way. Like
right.
there's a directness to it that you don't have to necessarily do in poetry or like
right.
in the perfect tweet or something like that. Like that moment is like that. It's like you just literally say what happened and
yeah.
kind of like let people think what they
and
would.
And that's strange to me as a poet. I'm like, well, I guess I'll tell you just what happened then.
Yeah.
But the humor has to be there as well, because it, in my family household, it was the absurdity or the surrealism that we have is like in reaction to the craziness of the household. So something like your underwear-clad father with his hand in a vat of pickles sitting in a room full of $10,000 guitars and telling you that he can't afford to send you to college, that's bad. That's a sad scene. But it's also totally like a lunatic scene. I mean, right. It's just the very fact of it, like all these accoutrements, all the elements of the scene, they are funny. So it's not like I can't put that in because I see that those things are there.
Yeah, there's a kind of a strain of American humor.
Mm-hmm.
Like the American male buffoon is a rich character, like appears in all kinds of art and literature.
I think it's actually an archetypal English character.
I think
of him as like J. Thaddeus Toad. I think of him as Uncle Matthew from the Nancy Mitford books. So there, I think it begins there. I think that there is a strain of American humor that actually has its roots in like the English eccentric portrayal. Even like a Dickensian thing.
And then like the American take on that is like bigger, louder, and
the dude from Family Guy.
Yeah.
He has a butt for a chin. Yeah. What about that?
Yeah. Yeah, well, and like if you listen to like radio ads, there's a trope on a radio ad, I guess it's in TV commercials too, where it's like the guy is kind of a, like an insensitive idiot. And like that's sort of the joke. And in your book, it's kind of like, what if you really had to like live with a person who had the attitude of like a man in a radio commercial?
Yeah.
Like
in
someone who had no like filter on sort of outrageous behavior and statements.
Yes, but not in the typical way that you would expect. So that kind of thing is based on this previously existing caricature.
Yeah.
If you really look at the stuff that comes out of my dad's mouth, these are things that like no one has ever
said
before.
It's all uncharted territory.
You're like, what are you talking about? So maybe this is something where every sort of culture or country or society like maps their own experience of this man, this boorish type of man that must exist like
right.
all across the world. Maybe they're mapping it onto the experience of reading this book, because when I was in England, everyone was like, this is like a British book. This is like a British sense of
really?
Humor that you have. Yeah.
I think of it as so distinctly American, but obviously I would, because I've never spent really
yeah,
any time
no, there. And they would like come up to me after the readings, and I was like, wow, I feel in a way like these people are getting it a little bit better. Right. It felt like a lot of the British reviews really got the humor of it a little bit better, I thought, than the American ones did.
What have the reactions been like among people who know you really well, your family? People who knew you sort of coming up through this process?
Yeah, they've all been very supportive. But again, like, you know, my mom and dad have not read it.
Our daughter wrote a book. Check it out. And you're like, eh.
No, my mom is so great, because I'm my husband will send her reviews and stuff and be like, oh, look, Karen, she got this really great review here. And mom's like, oh, I'll have to read it. It's like anyone else, you would think that you would hop right on that just in the gossip way. You would want to know what she said about you. My dad's never going to read it.
And you still live in, you live in Kansas.
I live in Savannah now.
Savannah.
We moved back, yeah.
That thing I read on the internet.
It's
dated.
Hard to keep up. No, it really is. Yeah, a couple people have asked beforehand because they know that I move like every year and a half.
What's up with that?
My husband is a third culture kid. Do you know what that is?
No.
So he was born overseas,
oh, okay.
and he grew up in Thailand and Korea,
yeah.
like for the first part of his life. And it's apparently an experience of people who like ambassadors' kids, missionaries'
kids. Is that
the
same thing as saying you're an army brat?
Yeah, something. It's sort of like that. So they don't really have a sense necessarily of rootedness or
right.
a place that they want to stay. They're always sort of looking around for a new thing. And he particularly like really hates authority. He like doesn't like America and that sort of thing, you know, so he's always like trying to find the place that feels the least American.
So he started in Kansas and then moved to Georgia?
No, I mean, we've been everywhere, man. Yeah. We were in like Kentucky, we were in Cincinnati.
How did you just pick this on a map or like what?
I don't even know. I just go like where he's like, well, I've got a job here. And then we were in New Hampshire, Florida,
yeah.
all
But you don't like
Colorado.
Get a job in some strange city unless you've applied for a job.
Exactly.
In that city. It's
yeah,
not like
yeah.
I've been like, eh, like I got a gig in Seattle.
No,
let's
I know.
Do it.
That's why it's so crazy. But it seemed normal to me because
yeah.
we moved constantly when I was growing up. My dad was always like burning some bridge with like an archdiocese, and then he would move elsewhere. So yeah, I thought it was normal.
Is it hard to operate outside of a, I'm making air quotes here,
I do
three fingers
try three
literary community, or is that something that you get from the online world?
I thought I wanted, you know, you have this fantasy when you're young, when you're a teenager and in your early 20s, of existing at the heart, the beating heart of a literary community. But then I grew up and I started to go around and go to readings and actually meet the literary people. And I was like, oh, no, I just want to be in my room. I was like, I don't actually want that, apparently. I thought that it would be some sort of like font of scintillating talk or something like that. But for the most part, it really isn't. Or maybe it's me. No, I think I'm a pretty good talker.
Do you think about, you've done two poetry books, you've done one memoir. Where do you go from there? Or what's the next thing that you're like, ah, I really want to like achieve this?
Oh, I don't think in terms of that.
I'm like one
of those little moles that's bumping its nose against the tunnel.
I talk to a lot of, like, on the show, we have a lot of like magazine writers. And they'll be like, well, I did this one profile of this person, but what I really want to do is this crazy expose, blah, blah, blah.
It's a different kind of ambition, I think.
Yeah, when you're like, in some ways, trying to craft perfect sentences and stuff like that, like, how does that ambition to improve manifest itself?
Well, you're concentrating on what is in front of you. So if I'm working on a poem, it's about the perfectibility of that poem to me. I don't think really about what I would like to do in the future. I mean, I have projects like that I have outlined and things like that, but it's never like, I'm going to interview Bob Dylan as he farts all over the Nobel Prize that he never received. I don't have any ideas like that.
What are your projects like then?
Oh, isn't it a secret?
Come on,
I'm working on poetry again.
Yeah.
Just to make myself normal in my mind. I mean, it's so refreshing to go back to poetry after whatever the hell I've been doing for the last 3 years.
Was it like rusty coming back to it?
A little bit.
Yeah.
But it's sort of like you can have muscle memory in your mind too.
Is the process of being a reader like really important to staying sharp in your mind?
I think so. Yeah. And there's a way of reading that is actually like writing, or it's you feel in collaboration with it. I mean, you have a pen in your hand, you're going along it in a way that's like half creating it as you go, and you're also just like strip mining it for anything you can use.
Yeah.
So when you're working on something specific, if it's a poem or if it's, you know, something larger, you have an eye toward that work. So everything you look at, everything you're reading, you're sifting for what can be gold, like what could be gold to you, what could be gold to this poem.
When you're like living your day-to-day life, or in the case of this book, you're like living at your parents' house, are you writing down details, phrases and stuff like that? Like what's your system for capturing life?
I have a notebook that is almost entirely just full of similes, like floating similes. Yeah. It's just like, well, this is like this and that is like that. That's what I'm doing for the most part. I'm just like writing down these little snatches. I hope that my notebooks are archived after my death because I want someone to go crazy trying to figure out what I was doing.
And then when you're starting to write, you go back and look at those notebooks and sort of those are starting
points. You can even
points.
Use them in like a divining way. Like if you're stuck, you just open them and you find something.
And when you were living with your parents and getting this book together, were you like writing down quotes?
Yeah,
in the
my
bathroom?
Notebook was just pretty much full of quotes. Yes, and you could hear in the bathroom, you could hear my father shouting up the stairs. So the bathroom was a great place to do it. And you would type them in your phone into your little notes folder and things like that. You always had to have some way that you could write things down in that household.
Is it weird to live your life and also like capture your life for material in that way at the same time?
A little bit. I think it would be weirder to be a professional memoirist because then you've really embarked on a vocation where like you are going to use your life for material. It felt different. It felt like just a discrete area of time that I had set aside,
right.
Like a little public park for people to piss in.
Well, and you'd kind of like, if you were going to become a professional memoirist, you'd have to go do something kind of outlandish now. You'd have to be like, and now Trisha does Asia.
I go to a nudist colony.
Yeah.
You know, and
there are people who live that. Like, I don't even mean to like shit on that. Like,
no.
That's a real thing.
Yeah. So I think at the point at which you think I'm going to write another one and then maybe I'll write another one, that maybe shifts things a little bit.
Yeah. So you're back to poetry now.
Back to
When, like, what's the, like, timetable on, like, putting out a book of poetry?
Oh, it's funny. My editor wrote me the other day, and he's like, what shall we say? Should we slot you in for a 2018 release or something like that. And I'm like, sure, let's see what I've got by then. Hopefully I'll be like seized by some demon of inspiration and just pour something forth onto the page.
I mean, is this, we ask people about money on this show.
Because money,
it's
okay.
A real issue for people who want to write.
Oh God, and journalists, like people doing magazine pieces, you have to chase it. It's absolutely awful.
So for you, like, you wrote this book mm-hmm. at a period where you're like, I don't have any money. Yeah. I'm going to write a book because I get some money doing that. And now you're going back to poetry, which, as far as I know,
I get poor
not,
again.
Does not pay very much money.
I should soon be a church
mouse.
So,
yeah, is that like planned poverty, or do you have like a different way of making money lined up, or do you not even think about stuff like that?
Yeah, I don't think about it, and that's my problem probably. But no, we thankfully have some set aside from the advance for this, so it should be all right. It's also true that once you reach a certain point, you know, that you do readings and speaking engagements and lectures and like visiting professorships and things like that, and that's a little bit where your income comes in.
Well, I was curious about that. So you never went to college. Like, you never went back and went to college.
Very uneducated.
You're not a college graduate.
No.
Can you go and teach poetry at the college level? Or is this, like, your dad's guitar buying going to haunt you forever?
For the rest of my life. So I'll never teach at Harvard.
Yeah.
No, it varies on the place. Like, it depends. But definitely some people will, for sure, hire you.
What is your relationship when you meet a young, you know, 19-year-old,
like, oh,
you're
like
at the
that.
Start of the book, who wants to be a poet? Like, what do you tell someone who wants to be a poet?
I just talk normally to them so that they can know that some poets are normal.
Yeah.
That's the best thing you can do,
they're
I
gonna
think.
Meet, they're going to meet you and
I
find
don't give
out
them
that
advice.
Poets are normal?
I'm just like, yes, I'm like, I'm representative of the species of poet. This is what we're like.
Well, thank you very much, Trisha Lockwood.
Thank you.
The book is out now, correct?
Yeah.
Yes, from Riverhead. Check it out. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And that was the Long Form Podcast. Thanks very much to Patricia Lockwood, who came in on a grueling book tour. Thanks to our editor, Janelle Pfeiffer. Thanks to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. Our associate producer, Courtney Harrell. Our sponsors, Audible and MailChimp. Go to readthissummer.com to learn more about MailChimp's Read This Summer, which we, the people behind this podcast, are curating this year in Decatur. We'll be back next week.